Friday, May 11th, 2007. We're going to go to the end of the agenda first. We're going to take Senate Bill 629 first, then Senate Bill 292, and then return to the top of the agenda. So I will begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 629A. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Senate Bill 629A relates to interest on money judgments against incarcerated persons. President ORS 137.183 provides that money judgments in criminal actions accrue interest at the rate of 12.5% annually for the first 5 years from the date the judgment is entered, and then at 4% for each subsequent year. It is presently irrelevant whether a defendant is sentenced to prison. The same rules apply, and the interest starts immediately. Senate Bill 629 amends ORS 137.183 to provide that interest does not accrue on any money judgment while the defendant is incarcerated. Once the defendant is released, interest would then begin accruing on the first day of the second full calendar month following sentencing, and the interest rate would be the flat statutory rate of 9%, no longer the 12.5% for the first five and then 4%. Senate Bill 629 would apply only to judgments entered after July 1st, 2007, which is the effective date of the act.
Thank you, Council. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Yes, I remembered that this morning. Half the time I forget. I am here today on a simple little bill. It is actually a simple bill, but I think it means a lot for a number of people. Senate Bill 629 was ably described by your committee counsel, but what it does is it helps victims get paid sooner, and it helps offenders in the transition process. Let me explain why I think that's true. First of all, an offender is sent off to prison for their crime, which is the right thing to do. We have a justice system in Oregon that makes people pay for their crimes. If there is an attached restitution order, that will continue. And currently, the interest is charged on the restitution order while the inmate is serving time. That may not seem like a big deal to you all, but if an inmate is particularly has a high amount of the restitution order, or if there is a long period of time of incarceration, that interest rate on that amount of money can be almost insurmountable. Sure. I would like to tell you that inmates make a lot of money while they're in prison so that they can pay these things back, but they don't. Let me tell you the average salary of an inmate. 28 cents to $1.15 an hour. 28 cents. Some of them make 28 cents an hour. From that, they must purchase their toiletries, their incidentals, and if they have anything left over, they can send some money home to their children if they have children. So the average person earns about $30 a month. If they are in the prison industries program, the federal government requires payment of prevailing wage in that program. So the Department of Correction then takes 80% of their wages for administration of the program, and those inmates can then make $100 to $200 a month. So those inmates make a little bit more than some of the others. Why is this important? Because an inmate, when they reenter society, they face significant obstacles. Significant obstacles. It is almost overwhelming, and I will tell you that because my brother was an inmate. My brother spent almost 17 years in prison, and when my brother got out, he had no judgment to pay, but he had significant obstacles, and it was almost overwhelming, and at one time, my grown brother cried because it is overwhelming. I have to tell you, can you imagine being in prison for 17 years? The world has changed. Computers weren't a thing that you knew about. Email wasn't anything you knew about. You've not driven a car in 17 years. You've not had a driver's license in 17 years. You've not owned a home, rented a home. You have no credit history. So when you come out of prison, you are faced with all of those obstacles. And, you know, that's life. That's just the way it goes. But if you want these people to be successful on the outside, if you want them to be tax-paying citizens, and you want them to pay back any judgments and become productive members of society, you've got to assist them. And that's why Paul Solomon is here today from sponsors in Eugene, and he's going to tell you about some of their clients. And I actually sent my brother to speak with Ron Chase, the executive director of sponsors, and Ron said, Vicki, I can't help your brother. He's got his head on straight, and you're helping him. You know, I'll give him a little advice. But my brother had me. My brother lived with me for, and my husband and my family for about 4 months until he could find a job, get insurance, buy an automobile, and find a place to live. Let me tell you, as an inmate, a former inmate, when you list on your application for a home, for any rental place, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Yes. And then they ask you the nature of the crime. And let me tell you, a lot of folks don't want to rent to you. So you have those hurdles. Then when he went to get a car, he didn't have a driver's license to test drive the car. He had to go get a driver's license because it had been so long since he'd had one, he had to take the driver's test, and he failed the first time. A grown man failing the driver's test, he came home and sobbed on his bed. I can't do this, Vicki. I can't do this. He had me. He had me saying, yes, you can, Patrick. Yes, you can. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, how many offenders who come back out into society don't have a sister or a family to say, yes, you have me. I'll help you. A lot of them just give up and they go back. It's so much easier just to go back. So all I'm asking is that we give them a little assistance here. We don't ask them to pay any interest. The interest does not accumulate. The judgment continues. They can pay on the judgment, but the interest does not accumulate. It's one small piece to assist these people. And, you know, finally, I would tell you the other issue with my brother is when he went to get car insurance, we have a little problem with that. You have no credit history. He got dinged. He had to pay the highest rate possible. And so these are the things that these people face that are just simply overwhelming. And fortunately, when he went out job hunting, he got a job the second day. And you know what? He's not just a laborer anymore. He's in management because he's done a fabulous job for his employer. And they gave him that second chance. And that's all I'm asking here. That's what our system is about. It's about rehabilitation. It's about serving your sentence and doing your time for your crime, but it's about rehabilitation and giving people that second chance. With that,
why don't we hear from Mr. Solomon, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Chair. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Paul Solomon, for the record. I'm the Director of Men's Services at Sponsors Incorporated in Eugene. We've been providing reentry services to ex-offenders in Lane County since 1973 and offer a variety of programs dedicated to men and women in transition from state custody back into the community. Sponsors program is based on the theory that people can and do change, and that a strategic intervention at the appropriate moment can serve as a catalyst in that change. The program holds participants highly accountable for their behavior, requiring all participants to work or go to school. Sponsors works very closely with parole officers, treatment providers, and a myriad of agencies which provide appropriate services. Given our long and successful history helping people succeed upon release, we are very aware and experienced with the range of barriers that people face when returning to the community from prison. Paying off court fees and fines is certainly one of those challenges. In addition to finding housing, employment, all of which with the barrier of having a felony conviction can be very difficult. I'm writing this testimony in support of Senate Bill 629. This bill strikes the appropriate balance between holding people accountable for paying their debt, but not creating an unreasonable burden that makes it harder for people to succeed when they return. Why should people accrue interest when they clearly cannot pay? I encourage the Judiciary Committee to seriously think about ways it can mitigate barriers to people's reentry while properly balancing public safety concerns and accountability. By removing reentry barriers, the state can lower recidivism rates, which in turn actually saves the state money. This is a prudent and fiscally responsible move toward fostering successful reentry. Senate Bill 629 is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Are there questions?
I think this is a good idea for virtually all people, but I'm thinking about a guy who wrote me a letter recently, Jerry Dusenberry, who was a high administrator at Bonneville Power in Portland. He molested boys, and he was able to afford John Henry Hingston. He probably has some money, so somebody like him, incidentally, in the letter he wrote me, he said that molesting prepubescent boys wasn't really the problem. The problem was the courts and the fleece and the hospitals caused the trauma to the kids, not him. So I don't think he's figured out quite what he's done yet. But anyway, if somebody like that has money, why should they not pay up front or be able to pay up front? Most of the people we know that are in there can't make a payment, and I agree with that. But the one-size-fits-all, I have a little bit of a problem with that. If there were some exceptions, so that if somebody had money, they could be paying that, I would feel better about that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I believe the court has the ability, when they enter the judgment, to require someone to pay immediately. If they have the resources, the judge has the right to set the restitution order. And I believe that can be taken care of. But if you think that we could draft this a little more narrowly, I'd be happy to do that, because I agree with you. In fact, I think last session we passed a law that says you can't make money, that if you make money off selling your story or something like that, you don't get the money. It goes back to the victim. And, I mean, that's what we're trying to do here. We want to make sure the victim gets payment. And we had victim testimony in the Senate and who supported this bill, because they want payment, too. And they're going to get payment, but they can't do it if you set up all these barriers for people. It's just too high of a barrier.
Senator Walker, I'm trying to coordinate this with another bill that we passed out of the House committee, and I don't know, actually I haven't followed what's happened to it since, which would have changed the way interest on criminal judgments is calculated. And it would have changed the 12%, 12.5%, 4% structure, which the Judicial Department told us couldn't administer their software system, such as it is, couldn't accommodate that. And so what we wound up with was going back to the 9% that it applied before, but then capping the duration, saying no interest will accrue on a criminal, I think all criminal judgments, not just restitution, after 20 years. So the idea is that there would be interest accruing at what's a fairly substantial rate, 9%. The judgment rate is higher than what, at least in recent years, the interest rate has been on prevailing interest rates.
Mr. Chair, that would have been House Bill 2311, and it was my understanding that we married the two concepts when we drafted the amendments to this bill, and I think there are some speakers here just to address that. Okay. But we had Paul Snyder speak to that, and it was my understanding that's why we changed the interest rate structure in this bill, and I think Mr. Stanford can remember that.
Chair McPherson, that's correct. What it says, the amended version of the bill, judgments in criminal actions bear interest at the rate provided in ORS 82.010. And, of course, right now that is the flat 9% rate or whatever. And so that's the basis for my statement as to what the bill does. But by wording it in this manner, whatever 82.010 does, that's what this bill would do.
That's correct, and that's my understanding. That's why, I mean, we spent a little bit of time with legislative counsel trying to marry the two bills, because Jad Limhouse, who's one of my constituents, had written to me, and he was very concerned about making sure the two bills work together quite nicely. And what we've also done with this bill is they're actually going to pay more interest, because the previous one was 12% interest, and then after 4 years, I think it was, it dropped to 4% interest. So now it's a flat 9% all the way through. So, it's probably six of one and a half dozen of the other, but I believe it's nicely wedded with the bill you passed out of here. And have we passed that bill in the Senate yet, Mr. Stanford?
Senator Walker, I don't believe so, but don't hold me to that.
I don't recall seeing it.
I saw Mr. Snyder mouthing Monday in the back of the room.
Okay, so. Great.
And to what extent are the judgments in question restitution judgments? I mean, there are criminal fines, but I think that the most substantial dollars involved in criminal judgments are restitution judgments where the amounts paid go to the victim. Am I right about that?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding they can have both criminal fines and assessments and then restitution. It depends on whether the restitution judgment is larger. I think you can see larger restitution judgments than fines and assessments. I don't know, maybe Paul has some comment about that. Have you noticed that with some of your clients?
You know, no, I can't say with any definity whether that's actually the case or not.
I think it's a question from Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First a comment and then a question. I just wanted to address Representative Barker's concerns. I don't know if a criminal judgment is collected like a civil judgment, but I would think that if there's a judgment, whomever had the judgment would take whatever steps they could through the process to collect it so that if somebody did have the assets or the resources, that would be collected, not even though the person was convicted. And then my question, Senator Walker, you mentioned that you believe that this would help victims get paid sooner. And I wondered if there's more to it than just, and I understand that the insurmountable burden that people face when they reenter. Was there something about the sooner that I'm missing? Why would they get paid sooner?
Well,
if this bill is passed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici. Let me read you the testimony from one of the witnesses. It's just a very short sentence from Arwen Bird. She said, as someone who is still owed restitution, I want for our system to prioritize helping survivors get the restitution that is owed to them. Part of that is understanding what changes need to be made to help the person who owes restitution succeed at paying it. It may seem counterintuitive for someone who is owed restitution to ask for a change that would delay the interest on that debt, but I firmly believe that this change will actually do more to help survivors get restitution in the long run. So what I mean by that is simply that it helps them get paid, and they can get paid sooner because it's not such an insurmountable obstacle, and people will make a larger effort to make those payments. I mean, contrary to popular opinion, all inmates aren't scumbag people, rats in a cage who did something bad. I mean, I will agree with you that there are some people in our correctional system who are probably not redeemable. But by and large, most of them do. By and large, most of these people have simply made some very, very poor mistakes in their life. And some will never, ever go back to prison again. I don't expect my brother will ever go back to prison because he's not a criminal sort of behavior type guy. It was a situational crime. And I expect it will never occur again. And so did the parole board when he was paroled. But what it does is it just gives someone a little more encouragement that, okay, I've got to line up all these things. I got to get a job. I got to do this. I got to do that. I also have to start paying on my restitution order. But my God, how am I going to do that? Because the interest on the judgment is so large that the monthly payment, you'll just never get ahead. So that's sort of my point with that, why I think it would be easier for people to do that. But I agree with Representative Barker that if they have the wherewithal to pay it, there's no reason to string that out. And I think the court can take care of that, but if you're comfortable with me drafting something in the legislation, I'm happy to do it.
Mr. Chair, if I can respond to that. In thinking about this, the amount of people who would fit that narrow category is probably so small compared to the overall group that I think this would be okay.
Okay.
Representative Krieger.
You know, you learn a lot when you come into this building with these type of issues. And from a police standpoint, you know, you come here pretty made up what you feel. But we've learned, I think anyone that's been here very long, that recidivism goes down when you have a job and when you have housing.
Mm-hmm.
And we need even, I think, improve the system we've got now. There are a couple of us looking at this and legislation for next session, so I don't mind going down this route at all.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Ann Christian.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. Not be brief. I offer my testimony in support of Senate Bill 629 to give another perspective, generally trial-level defense attorneys and their representation of their clients after when judgment is entered. We had an intern, Amy Alconich, and I, during the first part of the legislative session, who volunteered to help us out. She also volunteered to work up at Coffee Creek, which is the women's correctional institution. She and another three or four, I believe, law students are helping people who arrive, generally women who arrive at that institution. And what Tina told us, the biggest issue for young women generally entering that institution is debt. And so that was an insight for me, because most lawyers and their representation, their clients, go off to prison. And so I think this is a significant issue, and OCDLA, for that reason, does support this bill. One of the things that can happen with individuals, and restitution, I should add, when an individual is sentenced to pay restitution, that judgment for restitution has the highest priority. So the first dollar that comes into the court goes to restitution. And one of the things that Katina mentioned is the individuals at the Coffee Creek who talk about declaring bankruptcy. And if there's no help with regard to individuals who should have a second chance, we believe, to get their financial situation under control while they're in prison, then one faces the potential for bankruptcy. So we do support the bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Christian. I'm just kind of thinking here about how to try to mesh this effectively with some other things we did. And something we did in that other bill was to put a 20-year cap on the accrual of interest. And so I'm just sort of thinking out loud here, but help me out. If we were, if we're going to accumulate no interest during the period of incarceration, it seems to me a pretty persuasive case has been made that you're just digging a person in a deeper hole if you have interest accruing, particularly at a 9% rate during that time of incarceration. Then, if we're going to cut off the running of interest after 20 years from when the judgment is entered, which is, I think, the way that bill worked, that it seems a little arbitrary because it means the person who committed an offense that had them incarcerated for a longer time would have a shorter period of accumulation of interest. So I'm just wondering whether, to mesh those right, we should have an amendment that would say that there's 20 years of interest accruing and that this time out, in effect, while you're incarcerated, would start the running of that 20 years. So that a person who had a very short period of incarceration would have 20 years of accrual of interest, and a person who had a long period of incarceration would have a 20-year accrual of interest.
Does Mr. Chair, I do understand the concern, and I think what you're, and I'm thinking out loud with you, what you're considering is whether House Bill 2311 provides that during the term of incarceration, the 20-year cap is told. So, for instance,
yes,
a person who is serving a 5-year sentence, that the 20-year limitation in 2311 wouldn't even start running until the 5 years has been served.
That seems like the way it ought to work. I'm going to, without necessarily bringing you back up, Senator Walker, Mr. Solomon, does that seem like a reasonable result, that there'd be a 20-year, for everybody, there'd be a 20-year period of accrual of interest, but that it wouldn't start to, that period of 20 years wouldn't start to run until after you were released from incarceration?
Mr. Chair, that would be my belief in how this should work, because I don't think you should get a special deal just because you're an inmate and it's being and there's no interest running. I think your interest, your 20 years starts.
Right. Okay. Well, I think what I'm going to recommend we do is...
I think Paul agrees with me.
Wholeheartedly, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, that makes sense.
Okay.
So maybe...
Well, it may be that on looking at 2311 and how it's worded, maybe we'd conclude that it already works that way, but I think we want to bring this to work session so we can check that out and then work the bill after we make sure that those fit together right.
Okay. I'm fine with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Very good.
I think that's perfect.
There's nothing further on this. I'm going to close the public hearing.
Sure. I do have a couple questions. If somebody can answer them. How much is the interest on a... you know, that's accruing today based on the people that would be affected by this bill, and what is that interest used for?
Um,
I believe, Mr. Chair and Representative Kerman, I believe the interest goes into the criminal fines and assessment account. Am I correct?
Goes to the award, doesn't it? I may be wrong. I thought in restitution cases it went to the victim.
Yes, I think it does.
Because is it to try to make them whole because they're missing that money during that.
Right.
So they pay interest. Okay. I think that all goes to the victim.
Okay. I may be incorrect.
I believe that's the case, that on the restitution judgment, it's not only the principal amount, but it's the interest as well goes to the victim.
I guess I would like to have that clarified.
And have to clarify that.
How much is it today?
Mr. Snyder, did you have some guidance to offer?
No, I know what the percentage is.
Well, it depends on the amount of judgment.
Simple bill, Senator.
We're very thorough, Senator, over here in the House.
Yeah, and we've got a court reporter in the back who needs to get to court on time, so I'm trying to hurry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. It's even more complicated than that. As of right now, I don't think there is any interest because the law that was enacted years ago, we kept pushing off the effective date because we knew we couldn't implement it. And it's still not scheduled to take effect until July 1st of this year. So
right.
It never has taken effect.
Yeah, thank you for reminding us, Mr. Snyder. The way the law is set, though, when that interest starts to be collected, if it's a restitution judgment, it would go to the victim. And if it's an interest on a fine or assessment, then it would go into these other various purposes that interest and judgments provides, right?
Mr. Chair, our bill also talked about we're not going to pay the interest till the end because the victims wanted the money up front because we got into that deal about the computer couldn't handle that.
Under 2311, principal is paid first, yeah. Unlike the standard rule on how you calculate interest.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's right. I don't have 2311 here with me, but my recollection is that the way it worked is that interest would accrue when the system is capable of calculating it, and then it would be paid to the crime victim's account, not to the individual victim, but to the crime victim's account, until a point later on, and I can't recall off the top of my head whether it's a specific point in time, in other words, 4 years from now. But I'm hoping Kingsley Click will raise her hand and tell me if I'm getting off track. But at some juncture, right. It would be paid to the victim individually when the system is capable of doing that.
I see.
And I believe, Mr. Chair, on criminal fines and assessments, they turn the counties turn that over to collection agencies, and that interest is paid to the criminal fines and assessment account. I believe I'm correct on that. Am I, Mr. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Walker, there are arrangements with some counties with justice courts where interest is charged by the collection agency, I believe under the authority of the court. And that interest is used, I think, to reduce the total obligation of the court to pay the collection agency. But whatever money does actually flow through the court goes through a rather complicated process. There's a four-tiered process of priorities, which is one of the reasons why nobody could figure out how to make the whole thing work. And that is when interest is added to the principal, it further complicates it as to which tier gets what part of the interest first, and I'm sorry to make this more complicated, but it is.
Well, that's why we had Mr. Snyder work with us on this bill, and that's why it's drafted the way it is for the interest, so that it works with what they do in the county.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I'm clear or confused, one of the two. What I just heard Mr. Snyder say is that, because I'm asking how much money this is now that's coming in. What I just heard you say is there is no money coming in. Is that correct? So we are not charging interest to these victims today? I mean, to these criminals today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we are not charging interest at the circuit court level. In some justice courts, interest is charged. Legislative counsel did an opinion, I think it was Dave Hendricks, that said in his view interest could be charged under a general statute, but circuit courts do not charge it yet. In some justice courts, they do charge it. And the interest that they charge, I think for the most part, gets paid to the collection agency now. But as of July 1st, unless House Bill 2311 passes, as of July 1st, all these things will be an obligation on the part of every court to charge the interest and to post it to all four levels of priorities. And my understanding is that there aren't any courts that are capable of doing that. So that's why House Bill 2311 is necessary.
I hope this is
one last comment, and maybe it's a comment then. So the people that have been coming out that we heard testimony from, that this is a burden, haven't really been burdened by this, is what I'm hearing.
Mr. Chair,
it's a future burden that we're talking about.
I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
Quick question. Okay, thank you. Ahead. Which is it's related, but it's very different. Do either of you know if this type of judgment for restitution is dischargeable in bankruptcy?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, I have been a practicing court reporter in bankruptcy court for 24 years, and it is my understanding, not as a lawyer, but as a court reporter, that these are not dischargeable in bankruptcy.
Okay.
Other debts are, but
right.
These are not.
Right.
If there are no further questions, then I think we're going to close the public hearing and do some further investigation before we bring this back to work session.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 629 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 292A. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Senate Bill 292A relates generally to court reporters. ORS 8.340 discusses court reporters. In relevant part, court reporter is an officer of the court that keeps the official record or transcript of the relevant proceedings. Presently, there are two acceptable methods for this recording. One, accurate notes via shorthand or by a mechanical or typing device, stenograph, or two, audio recording. Where a court elects to record primarily via audio, present law allows any party to arrange for stenographic reporting if the party pays for it. But this option is specifically not available in Malheur, Union, and Wallawa counties. However, the audio reporting remains the official record of the proceeding. Senate Bill 292A modifies these rules. First, if all parties to a proceeding consent, then the stenographic reporting can become the official court record, but only for purposes of a transcript on appeal. For other purposes, the audio recording would be utilized. Second, Senate Bill 292A requires that any stenographic reporter have proper certification. Third, if the parties consent, they can share the cost of stenographic reporting. And then also, Malheur Union and Wallawa counties are no longer excluded. In addition, Senate Bill 292 clarifies that stenographic reporting may be utilized in any circuit court proceeding in which the court regularly uses audio or video recording, either one. The bill requires that any party arranging for stenographic reporting must provide the court with the name, address, and phone number of the reporter, and the party also must pay the cost of providing copies of the transcripts to the court.
Very good. Senator Walker, and I realize we have Mary Fagan. And she has an appointment coming up, so if we could bring her on, we want to make sure that she can get about her day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I have to be in another committee and then be on the floor. I'll give you 30 seconds. First of all, conflict of interest. I am a court reporter, but I do not practice in circuit court. I only did that once in my career, and I'm now in the federal system. Court reporters, you've heard it from me before. I'll tell it to you again. We are so important to the courtroom. It's not just because I think a lot of myself, but because we do keep an accurate record. And Ms. Fagan's going to tell you about all of the horrible things that have happened under the tape system. Any lawyer will tell you they much prefer a transcript coming from a court reporter than a tape machine. There are so many inaudibles and unintelligibles that it's unbelievable. And last night I had the pleasure of meeting a lawyer who was involved in the navigability case that was in this court, in Marion County Court, that Ms. Fagan will tell you about, and they had to completely retry that case, and it had a different outcome. and there was a lot of money involved, and it's all because someone forgot to turn on the tape recorder. We can't forget to turn on me, because I'm sitting there, and I'm going to tell you whether things are working or not. So the value here is just tremendous. It's become a different system of justice today because we've cut back on so many things, and this is the one area that I don't believe we should cut back on, and that's why we're doing this at least small piece to help keep the system the way it should be.
Very good. Senator, thank you very much, and thank you for pointing out what an important part of our justice system you court reporters perform.
Thank you.
Ms. Fagan.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Mary Fagan. I'm an official court reporter here in Marion County, and I'm also legislative chair of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. According to the National Center for State Courts, an accurate and complete record of court proceedings is an important goal for the courts. In many of Oregon's courtrooms, demographic reporters were historically served the judicial system in this regard until the budget cuts in 2002 and 2003. And at that time, there were approximately 50 official court reporters. Now there are nine. I am one of nine remaining official court reporters left in the state. Electronic reporting has become prevalent throughout our courtrooms. I also served as president of the Court Reporters Association during the layoffs, and a common thread in my conversations with the laid-off reporters and the lawyers who are working in the courtrooms was a strong concern about how this was going to impact the official record. I was presented with numerous instances of appellate transcripts that were incomplete or couldn't even be provided because of failure or malfunctions with the audio system. Senator Walker spoke about the matter that we had here in Marion County. It was a five-day bench civil trial. As far as I'm aware, all indicators were that the system was recording. The attorneys were going to be provided with a copy of the CD at the end of the five-day bench trial, and when the clerk went ahead to copy the system, it actually only had copied one of 5 days. It actually had only recorded one of the entire 5 days. So a mistrial was declared. A couple months later, it went to a two-week jury trial with a different outcome. The litigants, I understand, had tried to sue the state court system for their increased costs, and I'm not really sure what exactly happened with that, but I don't think it was favorable to the litigants. The 2003 aggravated murder trial of State versus Christian Longo, where he killed his family over on the coast, that was held in Lincoln County. That was digitally recorded. The transcriptionist who transcribed that ended up contacting one of the defense counsel to help her make the transcript make sense because of problems with the mics. There are mute buttons on these mics. Counsel oftentimes are more concerned with their case and talking to their client. They don't want conversations being picked up, so they'll oftentimes put a little book up on the mute button and forget about it. And that's what I understand happened in this case. Also, the transcriptionist claimed that the judge's microphone was hanging somewhere up in the ozone layer and could not be understood a good deal of the time. Now, I'm not aware that trial was, you know, remanded back because of inadequacies with the appellate transcript, but it is a problem. And anybody who practices appellate law will tell you that it is an issue. The Oregon Court Reporters Association strongly supports the passage of this bill. It preserves the rights and interests of litigants and the court system, ensures an accurate and complete record. Also, the proceedings would be reported by reporters who are brought in by the parties, and the rates would be negotiated, the market rates. There would be no cost to the court system. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Very good. Ms. Fagan, I realize you have a 9 o'clock commitment, so why don't we see if there are any questions of you, and then you'd be able to move on about your day. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to ask a question. I just want to make a comment. I support this bill, but I'm sorry that you had to bring it, because I think that we should be funding the judicial system so we have official court reporters. So I'll make that comment on the record that I think it's our responsibility as a state to have official court reporters, and I'm sorry that we have to have that done by private parties, but I'll support the bill and hope things get better in the future.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Bonamici.
Very good. Thank you, Ms.
If I may be excused.
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Smith, and I assume this is Deborah Solheim, will you?
Yeah. Chair McPherson, I think I'll let Ms. Solheim go first, and I'll just close very briefly after she's done it. That would be okay with you?
Very good.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Solheim. I live in Portland, and I'm the current president of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. I've submitted written testimony. I won't repeat things that Ms. Fagan covered for us. I want to thank Representative Bonamici for her comments. The Oregon Court Reporters Association believes that this is the right thing to do, and that is why we're supporting the efforts to bring this bill in. I will just point out from my own experience, there's some currently ambiguity in which would be the official record when there is a stenographic reporter brought in by private parties and an electronic recording running at the same time. I was part of a team brought in on a case in a civil trial in Coos County. The courtroom had replaced their stenographic reporter with the electronic system. Even though attorneys brought in real-time stenographic reporters for daily rough draft transcripts, the court insisted that for appeal purposes, the official transcript would be prepared from the digital recording. The parties were forced to pay for many extra hours and duplication of effort toward producing that transcript. This bill clarifies that in circuit court proceedings, any party may arrange at their expense for the stenographic reporting of proceedings. If parties agree, the stenographic record will be the official record for purposes of the transcript on appeal, and the courts will not incur any costs associated with the stenographic reporter. The Oregon Court Reporters Association strongly supports passage of the bill. Thank you.
Very good. Ms. Smith, do you want to offer your remarks, and we'll open it for questions?
Sure. I'll be very brief. My name is Laura Smith, Sheriff McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Laura Smith. I'm with Dave Barrows and Associates here today representing the Oregon Court Reporters Association. In their work on this bill, the association incorporated suggested amendments from both the Judicial Department and the Judges Association. That's reflected in the engrossed version of the bill. This bill was passed unanimously by both the Senate Judiciary Committee and the full Senate, and we hope that you can support it for us today. Thanks, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have Ann Christian signed up.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ann Christian, legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and I'll simply say that we strongly support passage of Senate Bill 292. And I would like to just go back and clarify with regard to the bill that previously was heard as far as bankruptcy. And I was out of the loop as far as the final decision that's been made with regard to restitution and whether it's dischargeable in bankruptcy. And so I'm pleased to hear that that is the fact, because I had referenced that inmates that are being seen by our former intern try to file bankruptcy, and I didn't want anyone to leave with the impression that if restitution is not, in fact, dischargeable in bankruptcy, that I was suggesting it was. Thank you.
Very good. Those are all the witnesses we have signed up on Senate Bill 292A. So if there's anybody here further to speak on that bill, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 292A and open a work session on Senate Bill 292A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 292A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 292A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I only want to reiterate my prior comment that I think it's unfortunate that we have to have private parties paying for something that should be a part of the judicial system. The court reporters are an integral part of the court system, and I think it's truly unfortunate that so many, I read in the testimony something like 40 out of the 50 official court reporter positions were cut, and it's our responsibility to adequately fund the judicial system, and that is a part of the judicial system. So I'm going to support the bill, obviously, but it's unfortunate that we have to put this burden that should be part of the court system onto the private parties.
Agreed. Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 292A moves to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Representative Bonamici, do you want it, would you like this opportunity to make
I'd
those comments to a larger audience?
Sure. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 292A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 306A. Or do we actually... Are you...
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 306 comes to you at the request of the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section, and Mr. Gil Feibelman is here on behalf of that section to testify. Allows the court to reinstate a terminated spousal support obligation if the reason for the termination no longer exists and reinstatement is just and equitable under the circumstances. Establishes factors for court to consider when exercising its discretion.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Feibelman.
Thank you. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, Vice Chair. My name is Gilbert Feibelman. I've been an attorney in Salem for 30 years. I specialize in family law, and I'm here as chair of the Oregon State Bar Spousal Support Task Force, which was formed at the request of the 2005 legislature to look at what was the existing ORS 107.136, which is an existing statute dealing with spousal support reinstatement, and to analyze it and determine with the task force whether or not it should be amended in some way to make it more broad and more accessible. If you actually look at the existing statute, it was actually very short. All it really says is the court has the power to order reinstatement if two things occur. One, if the reason for the termination ceases to exist, and if there still would have been some obligation. It provided no guidance to the court. It provided no expression of how far the court could do. In fact, the anecdotal evidence was that courts looked at this as a kind of up or down decision they'd have to make. Either they reinstated in full or they couldn't. And they couldn't consider anything other than whether or not the reason the termination no longer existed. In a review of this, we determined that that really did not give the court enough guidance, that the court should have much broader discretion to consider all the facts and circumstances. The court should have the ability to, and I have provided written testimony, but basically broad discretion to determine whether or not they should reinstate or if they should reinstate for a lesser period. Make it clear that the court has broad discretion to lower the amount. Make it very clear that the court has broad discretion to consider any evidence it deems relevant, so it no longer would be limited to why was the support terminated. It could look at what's happened in between, why support was granted in the first place. Look at all the circumstances both parties felt the court should consider. And so as a result, we also decided that there should be a 10-year kind of limit on coming back, partly because there's a lot of areas of Oregon law where there's 10 years caps. There's the 10-year statute of ultimate repose for bringing lawsuits. There's actually been a law in Oregon for, I think, about 20 years that says that if someone, even if they have an indefinite support award, if they don't make reasonable efforts to become self-supporting within 10 years, support can be terminated. So we ultimately compromised and felt 10 years was a good cap of coming back at some point. We've also... The debtors and creditors section wanted us to make it clear, too, that reinstated spousal support awards, just like modified retroactive child or spousal support, would have no retroactive lien effects. This is just like any other judgment. It's consistent with existing law. The family law section believes these changes are necessary to improve both the public's understanding of the statute and the court's implementation of the statute, to mark the court's discretion and considerations more clear to achieve a just and equitable result. One of the things that you might find unique about the way we wrote this legislation is we actually put in some examples for the court. So the court could actually not have to guess what it means or how to do it. We actually said, here's a couple examples of what would happen. And we just felt that when what good lawyers do is when they write judgments, they actually put an example or intent paragraph in. So if anybody's looking at it down the road, they know what everybody intended. And we thought, let's just make it clear now. So I would urge you to move Senate Bill 306 with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Feilman, that's the first time I've ever seen an example in our statutes.
Well, there was a question asked about that, and we found out that actually there are some other statutes, but I just don't know what they are.
Council.
Chair members of the committee, that was my first reaction when I read the bill, too. So I did a word search of the ORS, and I came up with about 5 to 6 examples. But in 11 sessions here, that's the first time I've ever seen it.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Feilman?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Glisnett.
Thank you. I have not studied this in detail, and I think the task force hopefully did a good job, but I did flip through here, and the fact about if they remarry or get back together, that you still have to pay them, and that seems strange. Is that same in other states?
Materials I provided, we also provided a rather lengthy our analysis where we actually reviewed other states around the country. There are states that allow for reinstatement. There are states that don't. There are states that don't. The majority of states just don't talk about it. Oregon's unique in the sense that we require judges now since 1999 to specify what kind of spousal support is awarded and the reasons. Most states don't require judges to say why. So what happens is when you're coming back later for a modification or a termination or reinstatement, nobody knows what was everybody's intent in the beginning. And that's so critical because in Oregon law, the intent of why something was awarded directly relates to why something should be modified or changed. Let me give you an example on a remarriage situation because there's different kinds. And this was discussed in great detail with Dr. Halpern, who sponsored the legislation last time, and he was intimately involved with the committee and with myself in coming up with this compromise legislation. Let's say you have and I'm going to use the typical situation, most likely it's the man paying support to the woman, although that's no longer the case in every situation. But let's say you have a marriage of 35 years, and the husband became a doctor, and the wife raised six, this is a case I had actually, raised six kids. She moved from state to state to state, went to a military base, did all sorts of things so that he could further his career. She kept quitting her job and to raise the kids and to start over every time she moved. And so now, 35 years later, he was making $600,000 a year and she was making $16,000.
Not on a military base.
No, he had found private practice. And basically, now he wanted to move on to another relationship. This was certainly an appropriate case for what we would call indefinite spousal support. In that case, all the reasons were stated. It talked about the moves. It talked about the sacrifices. It talked about the 35 years out of the workforce. It talked about all these different things. Now, let's say this woman hasn't remarried, but let's say she remarries. Okay, and 2 years after she marries, she finds out that her new husband's a sex fiend on the internet. He's abusing children, whatever. She dumps him like a hot potato. Okay, under Oregon law, she's not going to get any spousal support in a 2-year marriage from the new husband. She just can't. They haven't been married long enough. Probably that guy's going to prison. Can't pay anyway. So she would file a motion to reinstate spousal support. Now, the reason why spouse support was awarded, and I'm assuming in the interim, let's say support was terminated because the new hubby made a lot of money. Now, that circumstance has changed. So in a typical reinstatement case, you would look at what was the reason support was awarded in the first place. Well, it wasn't awarded because a husband owes a duty to support a wife. It was awarded because of the 35 years, the move, the 35 years out of the workforce. That doesn't change. Those 35 years out of the workforce didn't disappear just because she had 2 years married to some liar. That's just an example. The problem with the old law, though, is the court could have only said, the interpretation at least has been, I can only reinstate as it was before or not. Now, let's say factually the new husband, the second husband or whatever, won the lottery during their marriage. And the wife got awarded, $3 million as part of the divorce settlement after those 2 years because they won the lottery. Under the old statute, the court couldn't have considered that in deciding whether to reinstate. Under this new bill, the court could say, the reasons why spouse support were originally awarded still might be appropriate, but now you have $3 million you didn't have 2 years ago. So maybe under these facts, it wouldn't be appropriate to reinstate. That's an example of how this new legislation gives the court the broad discretion to look at why it was awarded, but look at everything else that's happened and decide what's just and equitable.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you. You know, when I read that, you know, I don't know what term to use, but I thought you taught remarrying the same spouse.
Oh,
because yes, kind of that.
Well, to tell you one quick anecdote, since in my career I had one couple that I divorced, the same couple three times. Every 5 years they would date, realize that each other, they get divorced, and then they found out they couldn't find any better, and they kept trying it over and over.
Thank you for your explanation.
Councilor Taylor, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. So, Father, I take it the reason the court could look at the totality of the circumstances would be on page 2 between lines 3 and 6 and exercising discretion. It talks about the totality of the circumstances. Is that the
right reason? Our intent was when we say totality of circumstances, that phraseology is contained in plenty of other Oregon statutes. There's considerable case law that says what's that mean. One of our goals is to use language consistently throughout this new bill that's already in existing law, so there's plenty of case law and statutes to say what these things mean. And that what that says to a court is you can look at everything. You can anything you, Your Honor, think is reasonable and relevant to making this decision, you can look at. You're not limited to a narrow set of facts.
Thank you. Mr. Feibel, what happens if there's no spousal support awarded initially, and then because of changing circumstances, the parties, it's a longer-term marriage, and then the parties split up, but they have relatively equal resources or earning power, and so there's no award made of spousal support, but then one of the former spouse's circumstances changes. Does this affect the ability of not reinstatement, but of initial instatement of spousal support obligation?
I'm going to answer that in two parts. This bill only deals with reinstatement when there's already been an award in the original divorce. If there's been no award, this bill has nothing to do with that. But just for your information, under Oregon law, if there was no award in the initial divorce, it can never be awarded later. You only get one shot to ask for it. You can ask for it to be reinstated, but if you don't get it in the divorce, nothing that happens after the divorce changes that. So the time to get your initial award is in the divorce.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Feibel.
Yeah.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 306A and open a work session on Senate Bill 306A.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 306A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cameron moves Senate Bill 306A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mm-hmm.
Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Mm-hmm. Aye.
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 Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reese?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rosen?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Senate Bill 306 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Cameron, you were jumped forward to offer a motion. Does that mean you'd like to carry the bill on the floor? Or we could see
if you need me to, I will.
Okay. Unless somebody else would. Representative Flores has volunteered. Thank you very much, Representative. Close the work session on Senate Bill 306 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 131A.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 131A is a product, I believe, of the Restitution Reform Task Force. It relates to providing a definition to clarify restitution law in the state. If a defendant is found guilty of a crime, a court has the authority to order that the defendant financially compensate any crime victims. Restitution is one of the present mechanisms to compensate a crime victim, and restitution is specifically meant to compensate a person's economic losses, which are objectively verifiable monetary losses. ORS 137.106 sub 4 allows the court to establish a restitution payment schedule for an adult criminal defendant or to delegate this responsibility to a, quote, or to an appropriate supervising authority, close quote. ORS 419C.450 provides the same authority in regard to juvenile offenders. Presently, the term appropriate supervising authority is undefined by either chapter. This omission has created some confusion over who specifically may create or modify a defendant's payment plan. Senate Bill 131A addresses this confusion by defining appropriate supervising authority as any state or local agency that is authorized to supervise the defendant. The bill also specifies that a supervising authority is authorized to modify payment schedules, but not to collect payments.
Fred Boss.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 131. It is a bill from the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. This bill will define supervising authority in ORS 137-106. ORS 137-106 allows for the court to establish a payment plan for a defendant who has demonstrated that he is unable to pay restitution, or the court can delegate it to a supervising authority, the making of that plan. And as counsel stated, that supervising authority is left undefined in the ORS, and that has caused some confusion. Senate Bill 131 defines what a supervising authority is and allows that authority to modify payment plans. This ability to modify is extremely important. Quite often, as we've heard in testimony to previous bills, a defendant's ability to pay can fluctuate throughout time. And rather than having it as the current statute is, that we take a snapshot of the defendant's ability to pay and set up a payment plan at the time of sentencing, this will allow a flexibility in the system and allow the supervising authority to modify the payment plan either up or down as the ability to pay of the defendant fluctuates throughout time. Thank you. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Boss. Any questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, just for purposes of clarity on the record, under the definition of appropriate supervising authority to mean any state or local agency that is authorized to supervise the defendant, can you give us some specific examples of a state or local agency that is authorized to supervise the defendant?
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Representative Flores. The community corrections would be one, the parole, probation. There is some question now whether or not they have the authority to modify the payment plans, and that is primarily what the bill is aimed towards.
Thank you.
Mr. Boss, although this is not specifically the subject matter of this bill, it does seem to me this overlaps a bit with the subject matter of the bill we heard earlier about interest charging on criminal judgments, and some of the most significant judgments, criminal judgments, are restitution judgments. And so I'm just wondering if how the payment plan, how it overlaps with or interacts with the calculation of interest and how these obligations actually get performed. Now, I realize that we do not charge interest on restitution judgments, most of them currently, so there's probably not much actual experience on the ground, but in thinking ahead to a situation that we're headed toward, we were discussing it earlier, where assuming that Senate Bill 629 is passed, then while a person's incarcerated, there would be no interest accumulating on the restitution judgment. But then as soon as they're released, their interest would start to accumulate, and it would accumulate for 20 years and then cease to accumulate under the policy choice that we made in House Bill 2311. How would that kind of regime, would that work well in terms of the perspective of the restitution efforts that the DOJ has been undertaking and trying to run a coherent system?
Chair McPherson, that's an interesting question. And this particular bill deals with the supervising authority, which establishes a payment plan and collects the money. It's my understanding that the calculation of interest and the actual tabulation of the payment plan or of the credits towards the restitution judgment happens with the trial court administrator's office. So whoever is collecting the money, be it the supervising authority, the court, counsel who garnishing, or the DOR, they all send it through the trial court administrator's office, who then will calculate what a part goes to principal, what part eventually will go to interest. I don't know whether that exactly answers your question.
So I think what I'm hearing from you is that the supervising authority would determine on what schedule the criminal who owes the restitution judgment would be paying on, the calculation of interest and the collection of it would be still handled through the judicial department.
Jim McPherson, correct. And I believe that's the only way that we can really keep track of, if you have a central authority, and this central authority happens to be the judicial department, that's the only way we can really keep track of it. Because actually the money on many restitution judgments will come in from different sources, even though there's a payment plan, that it can be collected in a variety of manners. These judgments are given to the Department of Revenue. They're also given out to private collection agencies. But having the central authority who keeps the ledger for this particular defendant is the manner in which we keep everything kind of consistent.
And I guess the other thing I was looking for, and it really goes beyond the scope of this bill by quite a bit, is just reassurance that the Department of Justice, which has done a lot of work in the restitution area, I've noted over the years of my service on this committee, whether you folks think we're on the right track if we were to go to that regime I was describing earlier, where there's 20 years of interest being calculated in restitution judgments, doesn't start until release from incarceration, and then runs for 20 years. Is that consistent with the policy choices as far as you understand them?
This is kind of the first time I've heard about it, and it sounds that way from my seat in the back. I don't know whether the Attorney General has a position one way or another on that.
Well, what I would urge you is if you could take that information back to whoever's been most involved with the restitution issues in the department and indicate to them where we're headed, and if we could get a little input back that before we move that other bill, I think that could be helpful to us.
I'd be more than happy to do that, Chairman McPherson.
Very good. Any further questions here from Mr. Boss? Okay, thank you, Mr. Boss. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 131A and open a work session on Senate Bill 131A.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 131A is the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 131A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cobb.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chairman Carson.
Aye. Senate Bill 131A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This seems like it could be a candidate for the consent calendar. How do people feel about that? Do you think this needs to be explained on the floor? I'm not hearing anybody who's speaking up about it needing a presentation. So I will move that we put this on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 131 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 169A.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 169A relates to the responsibilities of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training and the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training relating to the regulation of investigators. ORS 703.401 to 703.490 discuss rules relating to investigators, including licensing, conduct requirements, discipline, etc. ORS 703.480 requires DPSST, the department, to adopt rules to enforce these provisions and, in conjunction with the Private Security Policy Committee, to collect fees, adopt and administer competency tests, formulate an ethics code, establish a website, and provide professional development opportunities for investigators. Senate Bill 169A modifies these statutes primarily by specifying that the board, rather than the department, in conjunction with the Private Security Policy Committee, shall now, and again I'm articulating the responsibilities of the board, not the department, the board should establish minimum standards of fitness for investigators, adopt a competency test, establish rules of professional conduct, and specify what convictions for crimes or violation would result in the suspension of an investigator. The department would retain the authority to investigate violations, create a website, provide for professional development of investigators, and then collect fees. It would be the department that collects fees and not the board. The remaining provisions of Senate Bill 169A merely apply the appropriate terminology, replacing department with board and other statutory provisions.
Thank you, counsel. We have Brian Henson from DPSST here.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Brian Henson. I am the program manager for the Private Security Private Investigators licensing programs of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. This bill is before you today because at the end of the 2005 session, when the prior agency that administered the licensing program for investigators was abolished and the program transferred to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, the legislation or the language of the law failed to recognize that the prior board and the prior agency shared a common name. They were both called the Board of Investigators. So every place that Board of Investigators appeared, they simply made the switch in the language of the law to Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. So as a result, the board functions that were there historically were inadvertently removed. So what this bill is trying to do is it's trying to bring the board function back into the law. The board function is where the constituency, the investigators, have their voice through the policy committee, where they continue to play their part in making sure that the legislation, that the rules, the laws that affect their industry have their voice within them. So as we put this board or this bill before you jointly with the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training and through the efforts of the Policy Committee, we're trying to reestablish those two lines of delineation. Two other small issues that we added to this just simply helped the department in its administration of the program. The first being found on the first page of the A. Engrossed bill, the portion on lines 17 and 18 where we talk about adopting specific crimes that would constitute a disqualifying event. The language of the law currently is rather broad. It talks about any act that would reflect on an investigator's right or ability to do a job. The department and the board's current processes are that they've defined those crimes that would inadvertently affect an individual's ability to do business as an investigator in a state by identifying crimes such as crimes of dishonesty, deceit, Measure 11 crimes, those things. And then the last issue that we added to the bill, again on page 1 of the A. Engrossed bill on line 24, when the department was performing its duty as a and looking into allegations of noncompliance with the law, when an allegation came in and was found to be false, the department was to destroy all information relating to that. It makes it difficult for the department to administer and understand its workload as it's dealing with those issues. So what we're trying to do is say that we would keep that confidential, but we would be able to maintain that record to help us in the administering of that process, our investigatory role. Without it, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Henson. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple of questions to Mr. Henson. Did investigators concur with this change?
The Private Security Policy Committee, who has two investigator representatives sitting on it, they played a part in the developing of the legislative concept. The Policy Committee passed the concept, forwarded that to the board. The board passed it. So through that voice, they did play that role. And it returns it to its original process with the board having that delineation of duties.
Thank you. A couple of follow-ups, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
How many investigators have we certified?
There are approximately 700 to 750 private investigators in the state of Oregon. Excuse me, Chair McPherson, Representative Winsett. There's approximately 700 to 750 licensed investigators in the state of Oregon. Now, what we need to clarify there is that there's a whole group of investigators that lawfully practice in the state that do not have to be licensed. Those would be investigators who work solely for one attorney or one employer or an investigator that works for a public entity, such as Moulton Multnomah County Defense Lawyers Association. It's only those investigators that would, say, be hanging their private shingle outside their door and advertising to multiple clients that need to be licensed in a state. The private security program, on the other hand, has about 14,000 licensed or certified people in the state.
Thank you, Ms. Tanzik. Is there a national certification?
There are no national Chair McPherson, Representative Winston. There are no national certifications. There are national organizations that they may belong to, and then various states require licensure similar to Oregon.
Thank you. One final question. Then how does reciprocity work with other states, because investigations are going to be crossing states?
Chair McPherson, Representative Winsett, currently there are two reciprocity agreements, the state of California and the state of Louisiana, and the only one that is actively used at this point is the reciprocity agreement with the state of California. And what that basically says is that an investigator licensed in Oregon or an investigator licensed in California can follow a case, if it begins in the state of origin, into the adjacent state for a period of up to 90 days without having to be licensed in that state under that reciprocity agreement. Reciprocity agreement is, or the way that reciprocity is written into the Oregon statute, is that if another state has a licensing standard similar or equivalent to Oregon's, and if the other state's licensing authority agrees to it, the state of Oregon can enter into reciprocity agreements with those states. The current policy committee is looking at expanding the current reciprocity number of states that we have reciprocity with, but again, currently it is California and Louisiana that it is currently on the books.
I guess I had one final question is, how much training? Are you just providing the oversight? Are you actually providing these people some training that they're paying for at DPSST?
Chair McPherson, Representative Winsett, to be a private investigator in the state of Oregon, to be licensed as such at the full level, there's two levels of licensure. There's a provisional and there's a PI, or private investigator license. You come to the department showing that you have 1,500 hours of experience. So that base hours of experience is what qualifies you at the standard to become licensed. You then have an ongoing continuing education component, and the department does assist or does try to provide courses or other ways to have that continuing education provided, but the department does not have any mandated training programs that investigators are required to go through to become licensed.
Could, Mr. Chair, last. Good.
Go ahead.
So could they pay to go through the driving, the shooting, the weaponry training, and things like that if they wanted to?
Chair McPherson,
are there slots or positions you pull?
Chair McPherson, Representative Winsett, currently the way that the department is handling those issues, the pay-for-service issues, is that as we look to the future, those will become more and more available. The way that we've done it currently is, for example, and I'll use the broader program, the whole private security, private investigators program, is that, for example, if there's an instructor development school that the department is putting on, a certified or licensed instructor under the program can participate in one of those programs if there's room left. We first give priority to the mandated training programs, and then if there's room, they can participate. But in the future, the vision of the agency is that, yes, pay-for-use type of training facilities would be available.
Thank you for your answers.
Thank you. If somebody makes an accusation, it's found false, you used to throw them away. Now you keep them. If it's a false accusation, I just have a little niggling about that.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, what we find as we go through the process is that you have two types of allegations that typically come up. You have an allegation that somebody is violating the law because they are either an employee who has been let go and they're disgruntled, or they are a competitor that is upset because you've got the contract or whatever else is out there. So an allegation comes forward. The department treats them all as a valid allegation until we find otherwise. A lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of expense and process goes into determining that. Our understanding, our assumption with the current language of the law is that we didn't want any investigator to be held harmed by a false allegation. But by destroying everything, we lose the record of the effort we've put into it, how we've conducted those processes, what we've done in the past to determine if a case is false or invalid or if it's founded. So what we'd like to do is recognize the fact that we don't want to harm any investigator by a false allegation, but capture the work product so that we know what has gone on in the past. So it would therefore basically maintain what is inadvertently written in by the current process of destroying, maintaining an exemption by saying that it wouldn't be open to the public record so that others could not seek that information and then use that against an investigator if you know, saying, well, this person's had 15, you know, allegations or complaints against them in the last 5-10 years, whatever it may be.
Okay, but so you keep, I mean, then I'm not sure why you keep them. If it's false accusation, you've determined it's not true. And so if somebody has 5 of those or 10 of those, and then can somebody find out that there was actually complaints made, but you don't, and they were exonerated or whatever term you use? Or
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, under the current system, if a complaint is found to be unfounded, it's false, there's nothing to support it, we would never list it in the system as being a valid complaint. So an individual could not come forward and say, you know, how many complaints have been filed against investigator ABC in the last 3 years. We would simply show that there were no complaints because nothing was there. And any effort that we had put into looking into or investigating the prior complaints would actually be destroyed. It would be gone. So there would be no record of it at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Hansen, I'm trying to make sure I understand the sort of the background of this. The board exists already for other functions, but the problem was that when the statutory change was made in 2005 relating to regulation of investigators, things got shifted to department that should have remained board. Is that what I'm understanding the situation?
Chair McPherson, that is correct. The difference is that there were two boards, the prior board having been abolished in 2005. That was the Board of Investigators, both a board, a body of investigators who set policy decisions, and the Board of Investigators, the state agency, both being abolished. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training getting the licensing program, and the thought was is at that time it would also function as our current board works, where it oversees the policy setting decisions for the disciplines that DPSST works with, and DPSST administers then the policy that the board sets. But because of the language of the two prior entities sharing a common name, it was inadvertently dropped and not recognized that there was a board, a governing body, and a board, a state agency. So the name simply switched to Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and the board function was lost.
Okay. Very good. Any further questions? If not, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 169A and open a work session on Senate Bill 169A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 169A to the floor to be passed.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 169A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Olmert?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Senate Bill 169A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. How do people feel about having this presented as opposed to consent calendar?
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Wisnett. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 169A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 244.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 244 relates to the request of DNA testing. Last session, the Oregon legislature approved a bill to allow a person to request DNA testing of specific evidence if the person is either, one, incarcerated as a result of a conviction of aggravated murder or any person felony, or two, not in custody, but had a prior conviction for aggravated murder, murder, or a sex crime. The person must file a motion in circuit court accompanied by an affidavit containing, in relevant part, one, a statement that the person is innocent, two, a description of the specific evidence to be tested, and then three, a defense theory of this case. The legislature passed the bill last session with a two-year sunset provision. Senate Bill 244 removes the two-year sunset.
We have Andrea Meyer. Yeah, we've got Ms. Christian. Want to come up as well?
Did you sign up? Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in support of Senate Bill 244, known as the Post-Conviction Motion for DNA Testing Law. It was actually originally passed in 2001 with some limitations at that time because it was a new idea. We wanted to make sure that it some folks had concerns that it might be, quote, abused, or a lot of folks would come out and start requesting it, and that didn't happen. But we had a four-year sunset on it, and at that time it was supported by OCDLA, chiefs of police, DAs, and everyone. And this law is quite limited in its scope, and there are many safeguards intended to, and indeed to have prevented abuse. So to invoke the provisions of testing, as counsel said, the defendant files a motion to the court along with an affidavit that must contain a statement of innocence, identification of the specific evidence to be tested, a theory of the defense that DNA testing would support, the result of previous DNA testing if conducted, and a presentation of prima facie showing that testing of the specific evidence, assuming it's exculpatory, would establish any innocence. Any evidence tested under this law must have been secured in connection with the original prosecution, so this is not a situation where new evidence that has not been secured can be brought forward. The court must also review whether or not the motion is being used for purposes of establishing innocence and can only order testing if all those conditions are satisfied. When we originally worked on this legislation, there was concern that it would be used, as I mentioned a moment ago, by a large number of defendants seeking relief under its provisions, potentially imposing a large financial burden on the state, and that has not happened. As you all know, DNA technology has been rapidly improving in recent years, and it's important to develop a scheme that takes into account technology that we know exists today, but also with a system in place for the advances of technology that might happen 10, 20, or even 30 years from now. In the last 15 years, the Innocent Project has helped exonerate 185 individuals, including 14 who were sentenced to death. Now, last session, we urged this committee and this legislature to expand the law to include those who had pled guilty. The exclusion of those who had pled guilty was a compromise in the original 2001 bill to, again, address the concerns of high costs and the number of individuals filing motions. There were no abuses, no large numbers, and so we came back last session and asked that it be expanded. There is an Oregon case where this has happened, where someone did plead guilty and facing a death sentence, but was actually innocent, and I won't go into the details. It's in my testimony. But the point being is it can happen, but we agreed with that change to expanding it to those who pled guilty, and it was actually done in the conference committee, which I'm assuming Representative Barker, Representative Krieger, and Representative Olson, all the law enforcement folks will recall who were on that. But we also agreed to a two-year sunset. Sure, if there's problems that are going to develop, let's have the legislature look at it again in 2007. And there have been no problems. To my understanding, no one's really used this law, or if it's been used, they haven't had to go through the whole process, but testing has occurred when there's been the request and the safeguards and provisions are met. I want to mention one concern that I've mentioned previously in my testimony when it comes to DNA, and that is that we don't have consistent retention policies or any statutes regarding retention in the state of Oregon. And when we talk about retaining it for unsolved crimes, we also really need to start talking about retaining biological evidence when crimes have been solved. There is biological evidence that cannot be tested today that can be tested tomorrow. I mean, that happened in the past, and there is a story of someone who in another state had DNA evidence. It was the hair sample, first of all, could be tested, but the DA said, and again, this is another state, the DA said, well, that's fine, but the hair sample, if it's not you and it wasn't, doesn't exonerate you, doesn't prove that you were innocent. But 10 years later, the semen sample was testable, I believe, the biological evidence left, and it exonerated this person. And so while there was DNA technology when he was incarcerated, it improved, and it allowed him to establish his innocence. So we do remain quite concerned that we need to know what is happening in the 36 counties, what happens with the Oregon State Police, what happens with the courts after the conclusion of cases, and how is biological evidence being retained. And it needs to be. This law is really meaningless if evidence is not retained. It's great to have this on the books, but it really becomes just a piece of paper that gives no one any protections if we don't retain evidence. I also have to note, having testified and heard testimony last time on the statute of limitations, I was a little alarmed to hear that we may be outsourcing testing of the DNA swabs that are taken. I know we have a backlog and we need the funding, but I was quite concerned that there might be outsourcing to other states or private entities outside the state of Oregon. I have high regard for the Oregon State Police and the forensic unit. I think they do a superb job, and they have the safeguards. But we know that in other states there's been problems, and I'd just be very worried that we're outsourcing this. So I want to note that. I will summarize by simply urging you to pass this. I understand it may not be passed today, as there's maybe some amendments being reviewed for something a little bit unrelated to this issue before you. But I urge that this come back to this committee, and you do pass it, and we remove the sunset once and for all and have this law in the books in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Representative Krieger.
Andrea, you mentioned the Innocent Project, 185 individuals and 14. Is that Oregon or is that nationwide?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, no, it is statewide. And I'm not sure that we have any cases in Oregon. I'm not the best person to ask, but I'm not aware that we have any cases. I'm not sure the Innocence Project has had any, and that's good in some respects, but hopefully that truly means we don't have anyone innocent incarcerated, but the evidence is so hard to test if it doesn't exist.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, you said as far as you know, we've not used this law since it was enacted.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, what I understand from talking to state police and other folks is, and it might even be the courts, I'm not sure, that no one has had to go through all the steps, the motion and presenting all that before someone agrees, whether it's the DA, and I'm not sure because I'm not involved in this, agrees to test. So I think there may have been one or two requests filed, and they didn't have to go through the whole process. It added a tool, and then there was testing that happened.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
But I don't know what happened.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So my question is, should it be better policy to extend the sunset so we can still evaluate the effectiveness or the bill is going to work instead of just eliminating it?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, with all due respect, no. I think we've had this law on the books for 6 years now. We've had it revisited numerous times. I think the concern was the flood at the time that it was originally passed. It was a new law. Some felt that those who were incarcerated might look to it as an opportunity to create work. And so I think the time when it could have been abused and there were any issues of financial have come and gone.
If there are no further questions, Ms. Christian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. And we support the sunset being removed under Senate Bill 244. And very briefly to address some of the issues that have been raised. In 2001, I was a member of the work group that worked a lot on this legislation, and I was there as the director of indigent defense. And at the time, obviously, one of the big issues was what is the fiscal impact going to be of such legislation, both on the Oregon State Police, because they do the DNA testing, and also on the public defense system. And my memory is at the time we had one state that had enacted similar legislation, and that was the state of Oklahoma. And so I worked with an individual in Oklahoma with regard to our best guesstimate of what the fiscal impact would be and worked closely with the Oregon State Police, and I can't remember the details.
But two observations. The fiscal impact that we did have on the bill was relatively small, and based on what I've heard, is there's only been one case from 2001-2003, when I was still with Indigent Defense, where there was even an effort by an inmate to use this law. One of the things we did, based on my discussions with Oklahoma, because they had a large number of inmates who did use their opportunity in under Oregon law or under Oklahoma law. So I think a novel thing that Oregon did was made the provision in Section 3 that any inmate who wants to go forward and see whether or not they can make the case to the court, and it seemed counterintuitive at the time, but that individual does get court-appointed counsel. And the notion was an inmate who has the benefit of an attorney, more likely than not, in those instances where there's no chance at all that the person will be successful, they won't go forward. And I think that it has worked well, and we would urge that the sunset provision be removed. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for, again, once again, my clarity of understanding here, this bill originated in its earlier iteration in 2001, and then it had a four-year sunset. Did it? So 2005, they extended the sunset 2 years, so here we are.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores. In 2005, I think there had been some agreement by some to just remove the sunset, but because ACLU came forward with the additional expansion to those who pled guilty to now be included, we readily agreed to place back on it another sunset for 2 years to address the potential vein concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either of you can answer this question. There's a statement, Andrea, in your testimony about how the evidence must have been secured in connection with the original prosecution. That seems to extremely narrow the bill. And is it my assumption that correct that that's because of the whole chain of custody and making sure that the evidence is reliable? So, in fact, this seems to be a bill to address changing technology rather than new evidence.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, correct. Certainly our hope that if someone came forward with new evidence, that the DA and law enforcement, everyone would be serious in examining it. And the case actually that I mentioned in my testimony, I always mess up the names, but says Lovnik and Bovnik, that case actually, the reason they were released was because the person who committed the crime actually led law enforcement to a location where there was evidence, and I believe it was biological evidence, but I could be mistaken, but it was evidence that made it clear that he was the one. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, new evidence came forward, new biological evidence came forward to exonerate them. It just was led to, fortunately, by the person who actually committed the crime. And so in that case, obviously, law enforcement and our courts and everyone got it right and said, obviously, these folks need to be released. This was a mistake.
Thank you.
Talking about new evidence or new technology of using DNA for the purpose of proving innocence, they could flip it around. New technology to prove guilt.
Chairman Christen, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure what your question is. I mean,
those technologies might,
yep,
4 or 5 years down the line, show that someone who was exonerated. You only get one bite at the apple to convict. Mm-hmm. But you're getting 2 or 3 bites at the apple over time to prove innocence. And I don't want anyone behind bars, but it would seem that the people that are coming into the system since 2001, you're going to have more and more of those who have had at least the technology of DNA that they could use it for the purpose of proving their innocence, or the DA for proving their guilt. I would suspect the number of cases that are going to get involved in this over time would be less, other than maybe some other new sciences.
Right, Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger. I mean, absolutely, it is the new science where something may have biological evidence. And that's why I say over and over again, and I'll say it again, if we don't retain that evidence, even after they've been convicted, if we don't retain it, then the new technology is going to be meaningless. You mentioned something, and maybe I misunderstood, but I just wanted to briefly address that if someone's exonerated and then the evidence proves that they're guilty, I would be deeply surprised if that ever occurred. Our district attorneys across this country, our judges, our court system is not interested in releasing anyone unless it explicitly exonerates them. In that case, I cite in my testimony as a good example. The hair wasn't that person's. Well, it didn't matter to the DA because that didn't exonerate the person. It could have, they still could have been the one. It was the semen. And so when I testified a few weeks ago, when we only, there's very rare cases, if there are two rapists and the fact that it's not rapist A semen, that does not exonerate him because he still could have committed the crime. This situation arises mostly when it's one rapist and you find the biological evidence that was left from the rape and it isn't the person's. It's pretty narrow circumstances. You know, it might also be with a murder where it's so clear that is the biological evidence left by the perpetrator. You have 12 minutes. So, again, it's so narrow. It really is. And I hope that we continue to look at this area in a larger form.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I know there's a, I think it's 20,000 backlog of DNA federal felony convictions that haven't been run in the state police system. So I would assume that anybody who is going to use this would be somebody who is not in that backlog, obviously. Their DNA would have to be run even to go through this process. Would that be correct?
Well, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, in a way, what they are doing is collecting DNA and then matching against unsolved crimes. So Right. Let's say the person used their DNA, the evidence left in their crime, and they were exonerated of that crime. But they were, for some reason, found that once their swab was run in the system, connects them to another crime. Well, that doesn't go away.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then I'm going to excuse these witnesses and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 244. And as was mentioned earlier, there is a follow-on amendment that's not been prepared yet. That's within the relating clause. It's something that Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee had mentioned that was going to be coming on. So this will be coming back for us when we have a chance to look at that. So this will come back again, and that concludes our work for today. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.